Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Kate Winkler Dawson. She is the author of the brand new book, American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. Kate's a journalism instructor at the University of Texas at Austin. Instructor, professor, what's your title?
Associate professor, if you want to be all technical.
All right. I didn't want to devalue the position at all, but this book, I tell you, it takes us back, and I think people get so pigeonholed in watching Forensic Files now and the other shows that are on that they think this whole idea of CSI is something new. You take us back 100 years ago where this was born. So who's patient zero for the CSI?
Well, you know, it's kind of up in the air. Really, the American forensic scientists were looking to Europe during this time period. And the forensic scientist we're talking about in my book is Edward Oscar Heinrich, who at this point doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. He was so well unknown at this point. Really, it begins with him and some of his contemporaries who were exploring handwriting analysis, and this is in 1910, a long time ago, and he opened his first forensic lab, and it just sort of begins with, you know, all of these people who are shifting from civil suits, so determining handwriting analysis that, you know, maybe it's false signatures on wills, and realizing that this can be translated really well in criminal cases. So it sort of starts there in the early 1900s.
Where is his lab actually located?
It's in Berkeley. So he has a house in Berkeley, which was about three levels in Berkeley Hills, which is a beautiful area. It was then, it is now. And his lab was in the basement. And then later he opened an office in San Francisco, which he subsequently had to close because he sort of struggled with money his entire life. And that's a big part of the storyline.
The comedian John Mulaney has a bit where he talks about the whole idea of CSI before DNA was involved. And he says, well, police had to come in and say, if we don't have a hunch as to who did it, then we're kind of up against a wall. And then he would also use the analogy that the bank robbers back in the day would come out and say, when the police get here, tell them the Barker gang did this. And I know it's a funny bit. It's not quite that simple, though. But as Heinrich was beginning this whole idea of CSI, forensic analysis of evidence, was it looked at as magical hocus-pocus at the time?
It was. I mean, this was a time when people were slightly distrustful of scientists, particularly people who were taking the stand like Heinrich, and making really big mistakes. And the mistakes were they did not know how to translate complicated science to, you know, the layperson. I mean, this time period, you know, 1910s and the 20s, and even later, you couldn't expect anyone on a jury to have a college education necessarily, and maybe not even a high school education. And they're using scientific terms that are like five syllables long. And so it was really difficult. It was this interesting, perfect storm of scientists really learning things, and advancing forensics, but it was a little too fast for the juries and even many of the judges. And so, you know, at this point, anybody could claim that they were an expert because there were no real credentials. I mean, there weren't certification classes. So it was, they call it the Wild West of forensics.
What was Heinrich's education level?
Well, outstanding compared to the rest of the experts who were out there. He would call them charlatans frequently. So he started as a pharmacist when he was a young man. His father died really tragically, which I talk about in the book. And he is left to support the two sisters and his mother. And so he had to drop out of high school in Tacoma, Washington, and he became a pharmacist by, you know, taking reading these books and not even taking formal classes because he couldn't afford it. But he passed the state exams and he became a pharmacist when he was 18. And so there he learned about drugs. And then he ended up going to UC Berkeley. There he learned about chemistry. So he graduated with a chemistry degree. He learned about all the sciences, biology. He was a teaching assistant. And then he went on to, really his first real job was a sanitation engineer and chemical engineer for the city of Tacoma. So he had this education that just played perfectly with forensics. And not just perfectly with forensics, but he was advancing things like forensic geology, forensic entomology, all of these things that people were just clueless about. But it just common sense to him because he knew all of these skills.
really the breakout case for him involved a botched train robbery. What happened?
Well, so, you know, to try to keep it super short, there was a train that was traveling from Oregon into California, and it was robbed, actually not even robbed, because they never got away with it. They put too much dynamite down and blew part of the train. They killed four people, and all Heinrich was left with as a clue after the robbers took off was a pair of overalls. And, of course, the federal agents had already examined them and said, ah, there's really nothing. There's a little bit of grease on here that's probably mechanic's grease, and that's it. And he went through the overalls, you know, under his microscope, and just using his skills in deduction and using pretty much every skill he had acquired along the way. And he was able to collect somewhere in the 20 to 25 range of different pieces of evidence, trace evidence that no one else was able to see. And it was really remarkable. He was able to not just identify specifically one of the robbers through a clue that everyone else had missed, but he was also able to build a profile of this man that was completely the opposite suspect that anyone thought it would be. So that really is, you're right, what put him on the map, and that's what gave him the nickname America's Sherlock Holmes.
And it's funny because scientific developments in forensic science is not a linear proposition. There's been things that have been tested over the years and have not worked. People have gone to prison on things like bullet lead analysis, which has now been completely discredited. But when you saw what Heinrich was doing, did he have ideas that he tested and didn't work? And what has been able to be built off of the base that he provided?
Well, one of the things that he really disapproved of was something called graphology. And graphology is reading someone's handwriting and making assumptions based on their personality. And he thought it was a joke. I mean, a lot of these experts would come and they would read, like in one of my cases, a ransom note. And they would walk away and say, this person is clearly demented. And he would just sort of go, okay. You know, that is a silly assumption based on whether your U's close at the top. And so, you know, the theory behind graphology really struck him as something that was not only unreliable, but dangerous. Because if you lean too heavily on what we call a junk science, which we have identified many more junk science now, then, you know, you really risk letting the real person get away with it because you're concentrating on someone else. So unfortunately, Heinrich really did push forward some junk science in his career. He was, if not the first, one of the first cases entered into criminal court on bloodstain pattern analysis. So, you know, if someone's shot or stabbed or beaten, how the blood lands on the floor or on the wall is supposedly able to tell you how tall the perpetrator is, where he was standing, you know, like this host of evidence that is all subjective. So he really did jump in and develop what we call pattern matching forensic science. So fingerprinting, you know, shoe prints, and he'd never worked on bite mark evidence, but that was, you know, that is one of the things that's considered junk science. So he did, you know, he did develop really, really good, solid forensic science, but he also supported some bad science. And in his defense, this is the beginning. This is an era of forensic science, and you're going to make mistakes. And you don't have time to do the research and the peer reviews that you should. You're just trying to keep up with the incredible amount of crime generated by prohibition.
I'm chatting with Kate Winkler-Dawson about her brand new book, American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Putnam. Something else I found interesting in the book was how Heinrich essentially became a tabloid celebrity of his day. And people, it seems like, I wondered this when I was reading it, they were fascinated by crime even 100 plus years ago in this country. And so people who are the science, the geeky guys, I think of Thomas Noguchi, who was the longtime coroner in L.A. County, people know his name all over the world because of crime. How does the fascination with crime for the general public at that time compare with it now?
Well, I think, you know, we see this, we're seeing this resurgence of fascination in true crime here now, particularly with women. Women are the largest audience for true crime. And I think that in the 1920s and earlier, I will frequently read stories that claim that this is the crime of the century and the trial of the century. And, of course, I've used that in some of my books, too. And I think it's not just people fascinated. I think it's a little bit of a chicken and the egg, because remember we have William Hearst and his newspapers on the rise during this time period, and they are dictating what people read and what they think is interesting. These newspapers are these true crime stories, particularly with a celebrity caught in the middle of it. I mean, that just generated sales through the roof for these newspapers. So I think it's a combination of yellow journalism with a, well, thank goodness this isn't me. It's happening to someone else. So it's a little voyeurism, too. But I think, you know, if you start with the salacious tabloids that was happening in the 1800s in London during Jack the Ripper's time, the Penny Dreadfuls, you know, people have always been really interested in true crime. So I don't think it's anything new. I just think that it's now in some ways becoming a little more nuanced. I am trying as much as I can to sort of elevate true crime, where I'm rooting it in real history, in real events, why these crimes make a difference then, why they make a difference now. And so, you know, I try not to dwell too long on all of the salacious and sort of uncomfortable details of the crime and really talk about the context without being boring.
The story of your research for this book is almost as fascinating as the book itself, the product that it produced. But at UC Berkeley now, there is an entire bunch of stuff that you can research as far as Heinrich goes. Can you explain how his family came upon this stuff and decided to essentially donate it?
Well, what happened was, you know, when Heinrich died in 1953, his family, which was his wife and two sons, couldn't sort out what to do with his lab. And Heinrich taught at UC Berkeley for decades. He started the first criminology classes along with August Vollmer, who was considered the grandfather of modern policing. They worked together and they created these classes that were at first offered to cops and then more to the general public. And so he had this legacy already at UC Berkeley. And I kind of joke that his son, Mortimer, just a few years later sort of just did a data dump on UC Berkeley. He took a truck and put Oscar's entire lab in his collection, and there it sat for more than 60 years because it was a very, very large collection, and many archives are very understaffed, and they have to pick and choose based on the person's notoriety, based on the size, what they're going to sit down and catalog, because it's such a meticulous process. You have to sit, you have to sort, you have to create a finding aid. So if anybody who's ever done research can really appreciate what these archivists do. And so I had to justify to the lead archivist, whose name is Laura Michaels, why she should jump into this archive and look into more than 100 boxes. And we are talking 100 packed boxes. It had his case files. It had his personal journals. It had, you know, dozens and dozens of newspapers that were bound that he hadn't even opened. He was a hoarder, for sure. So she needed a good reason to do it, and I gave her a compelling reason. I thought, this is a man who made history. He deserved to be in a book. His cases are exciting, and he is the real Sherlock Holmes. And that convinced her, and it took a long time, but she finally did it, and I'm so grateful, because the book would not have you know, been in existence without Laura.
When you archive something after that long, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, but is there a possibility that you run into some things that you just don't know where they put, where they go, or what case they go with, and there's a chance that they could become misarchived?
There is. You know, thank goodness this archivist, Laura Michaels, is meticulous. And also, one of the things when people ask me about the legacy of Oscar Heinrich is that he cataloged. He was the first real forensic scientist to organize how you should, you know, preserve evidence. And he did a fantastic job, not just at the crime scene, but back at his lab. It was a little haphazard before he created this blueprint for other scientists to work off of. And so we were lucky because he really did catalog things sort of correctly. But definitely, you know, part of the archive I started to get into, and, you know, in Fatty Arbuckle's file, which, you know, Fidel Arbuckle was a huge silent film star in the 1920s, and he went on trial for manslaughter and assault for supposedly killing this woman accidentally during a party. She was an actress named Virginia Rappet. So I'm digging through that case file, and with it comes a box, and I'm sitting with the archivist, and I hold up this lock of hair, and I said, what is this? And she said, oh, that is Virginia Rappet's hair that Heinrich took after she died for hair comparisons. So that is incredible, and luckily he categorized everything, so we know where these cases come from. But there's bomb parts, there's a locket from a woman who was run over and killed six times by her own limousine. He kept everything, but he also labeled it, which was really great. I suspect other collections are not like that.
All right, the book is American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI by Kate Winkler Dawson. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Kate, just a completely entertaining book, a biography of a man that I'd never heard of before I read your book. And so I thank you for bringing this to light for us and for joining us today.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.